Welcome to the Friday Workplace Briefing. Workplace law changes so quickly. Tune in weekly to find out how the law is changing and what you need to do.
G'day, Nina. How are you?
Good, thanks, Andrew. How are you?
Look, I've had 3 nights of 4 hours sleep and been travelling, getting up at 4 a.m. So
yeah, you've been very grumpy. I'm
dusty and grumpy. Anyway, that's me. That's me. But look, interesting week today. We do. I feel like it's like a football panel, doesn't it? It's been a big week in workplace.
No, but it has. Like, there's been weeks where we're struggling to find content, but this one is too much.
You don't need to say we struggle to find content. That's not true. There's moments where it's a bit thin. But look, what I do think's been really interesting is in the media. It's not a case that's been run, but it's about to be commenced, which is the Kilmington Grammar case.
Yeah, the blade charges.
And they've laid what are called Section 23 charges, which is injury to another. In this case, it was a child who had a diabetic condition and died of diabetic complications when they were travelling with the school overseas.
Yeah, as part of World Challenge Expo, who's also been charged.
And look, the reason we just want to talk about this, yes, we do have school clients and we've talked regularly on outward bound risks. But partly because Nina and I over the last 3 or 4 weeks have been banging on about known high risk. Here you have a child with not a life-threatening disorder. Diabetes, very common amongst kids, but where it is a known high risk if it's not managed properly. And what the charges suggest is there was no proper system or management methodology that sat around managing a child with what is an otherwise uncomplicated illness. And charges have been laid. Now, we've got 3 or 4 cases today we're going to talk about to actually drive the point home. But since Wakakiri and a number of other cases we've had, what we keep saying is, and I hope it's getting through, is where you have a known very high risk, the obligations, don't worry about positive duties, just basically under the legislation before you get the positive duties is to identify the nature of the hazard, determine the risk and institute controls that relate to the level of risk. So not just having a policy.
Yeah.
It means you need to demonstrate that you've got the relevant tools, you've got the relevant expertise, you've got a whole lot of things that come along with managing that risk. And in this case, it's been alleged that's not the case. So we'll keep doing this because we've got another case where there's been an incredibly high fine later on we'll talk about. But if we go out into our site and we know we have hazards which have high risk and we're not actually building a proper controls, we may as well carry a toothbrush waiting to go to jail. Am I still grumpy? Next. Okay, so let's go on anyway. Okay, this is, you might remember in my infinite wisdom, I said multi-employment agreements under the new changes.
You were like, never going to happen.
Well, now a bunch of idiots have got together and done it.
Well, it's going to vote next week, but it looks like it's going to pass. <Nina. laughs>
So in this multi-agreement in the air conditioning industry, there is a pooling of employers across, at the moment, 9.
Yeah, but probably 16 in total.
Which requires you to offer overtime.
And additional work, yes.
To people within that pool of all those employers.
Only permanent ones.
Yeah. Before you can engage a casual or labour hire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know who thought that was a clever idea. I mean, just think about payroll. Just think about the obvious things. Think about the collusive nature of work and the breach of the ACCC. Think about everything that's stupid about this. But can you imagine Nina rings up and she says to me, oh, Andrew, look, we're a bit slow on this. I'm going to need to do overtime. This is an hour before we have to do the overtime. And I go, wait a second, I'll ring up 16 other businesses.
No, you can give it to that person.
But you can't give it to labour hire. You can't give it to casual.
But in that example, you wouldn't get labour hire in that last
thing. Well, you might get casuals, though. Anyway, my point about this, how dumb is this, okay? Well, let's use a better example. Tomorrow, we're going to have to do a whole lot of work and we've only got a small group of people who are going to be available that day. And you go, all right, what time is it? It's 5 o'clock. I'll ring the other employers and see, and I'll wait back to hear from them. And then no employee who's offered that is allowed to unreasonably refuse it.
Yeah, so employees can't unreasonably refuse. But
how do you prove they've been asked?
But I think it will depend on the process they have in place. I don't think it would be through the other employees because they wouldn't want to know that. I suspect it'll be like how government has a pool of employees that they go through and it's through a central database.
No, I know.
I think there are like going to be issues in terms of like productivity because they're not going to be using casuals. I don't think it's as bad as you say. I think actually for once the union will work quite creative in finding something different. But watch this space.
I think it's the usual thing that happens when we create things which are designed to celebrate union membership and we build something which is impractical and stupid.
All right, on to the next case.
And by the way, you know, the risks around safety are really obvious. We start getting people doing repetitive overtime.
Yeah, but it's also like inductions and stuff like that if they're from a different site.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah.
All right, so this is the case involving an investigator who was involved with lots of very traumatic types of investigations, so child safety matters, things like that. And she filed a claim saying that she was forced to resign because they didn't accommodate her concerns and basically safety risks.
And remember, this is agitating court services and Komisaroff case that we've talked about.
Kozaroff,
yeah. Komisaroff is how I feel today, Komisaroff. But both cases where people were involved in seeing traumatic and difficult things.
Very similar.
Where no system was introduced, and as a result of that, people suffered alarming mental health issues and leading to death.
This is the opposite, though, because it's what you can do right.
This is what you can do right. So they did make a whole lot of accommodations and they pressed her for a medical evidence.
Yeah.
And she refused to provide it.
Yeah, but then she resigned until she got PTSD. Yeah. But with no evidence, there was no link to the resignation.
She lost. I think the important thing is she lost, but they did all the right things, which is they utilised the strategy around psychological hazard management, saying, look, I hear what you say.
They took her off investigation.
Took her off. Let's investigate what we can do. Let's work out how we manage this. Now give us the medical evidence so we can accommodate properly. Yeah. No, she says, oh, I'm backed into a corner. I'm going to leave. And the court goes, bad luck. Next case.
Oh, my God. So this is the trolley worker.
Yeah. This is a young kid with, I think it's a young kid, I've probably said that, but everyone's young to me, with a number of different disorders that felt real discomfort in the nature of the high-vis gear that he was required to wear for the supermarket.
Yeah.
He didn't disclose to them the nature of his disorders.
Yeah.
But he did say to them that it was uncomfortable and raised a series of safety issues about
causing him to vomit and dizziness and stuff like that.
And if you go back to Burke and Suncorp, the moment you're put on notice under Section 22 in Victoria and under the other monitoring health issues, the moment someone's behaviour or condition is demonstrated to have some health basis to it, at that stage you need to stop, investigate and think.
Yeah, but the crazy thing is, right, the next step was he tried to fix the problem for them. He brought his own high-vis top, which was more breathable and didn't cause him any issues. And they said to him, if you don't wear our uniform, you're going to get fired. So he was like, nah, I'm out, and went home, and they said, that's your resignation.
And the evidence was it wasn't a resignation.
Yeah, it was like heat of the moment.
Heat of the moment.
And it was just he was going home for that day. Yeah. Like, that's just so crazy.
Funny case. So he wins. There's a win, that one. Let's go. But I do want to say that when people get upset and then they walk out on you, it's not an abandonment of employment. It's not resignation. The heat of the moment cases say really, really clearly, if the person comes back and says to you and said, look, I'm sorry, I was distressed, whatever, their employment is continued. They're not terminated.
Mm.
All right, so we're going to move on to the next case. This is the case I hinted about earlier, which is where trucks changed over carrying trailers on what was a main road, so a high-risk area. And Nina and I were giggling about it before. We just go, well, it's not that high risk. I said, well, it is a main road, Nina. We said, but anyone knows it's high risk. And then we said, yes, everyone knows this is high risk. Yeah. And having people jumping in and out of trucks, changing over, carrying trailers, means traffic management is the biggest issue that is alive. And this person got knocked over and killed. And as a result of that, there was an $800,000 fine. The case is not an important case other than to say, once again, here is an organisation that did know the risk.
Yeah, it's reasonably foreseeable.
Yeah, didn't know that it was a high risk and had no systems, not even high-vis jackets or things that were
required. No risk assessment.
Yeah, none at all. So can I just say, you see how these cases, they just keep coming up because the regulator can't lose and we've lost a life when we shouldn't have lost a life as well, when it was so preventable. Okay.
Next case.
We've got a lot to go on today, haven't we?
Yeah, but this one, we have some funny ones.
Okay, well, I think this is the best case we've got today, and really it has no law except it's funny. And this is a person who was an employee of a religious organisation who went and got vaccinated and was fired for being vaccinated.
And she also worked completely remotely and wasn't aware that they had objections against it. And they wrote her this damning letter that said, your actions breach our constitution, so we've got no choice but to let you go.
Oh, it's Nutterville, isn't it, really? It's just crazy stuff. And to think they continue to run it to trial, I mean, you've got to wonder who thinks, well, this would be a good idea to run this absolute loser to trial.
Yeah, but they were lucky because she only asked for 12 weeks because she got another job, and the Fair Commission said she could have definitely asked for more and won it more.
Yeah. Anyway, look, we've got a bit tired of anti-vax stuff, and this is one where it's pro-vax.
Yeah, it would have been slightly different. We did discuss this if she was just like a member of the church rather than employee, because the restrictions around discrimination apply to employees, not so much. Well, churches are in a grey area, which we'll discuss more about later.
And also, you know, equal opportunity legislation and discrimination is quite different across state and federal. So at a federal level, it may well protect members. At a state level, it probably doesn't for those sort of things. So anyway, interesting case if that was the case, but that was not the case. Let's move on. All right. This is really a complex case. And I warn you, when you read case law, that sometimes lawyers get very excited about issues which are utterly irrelevant.
Yeah.
And this is a case where there are pages and pages of irrelevance. This is a case where a person who was on a visa pursued while they were driving from a car from Moree with their manager a bonus that he was due to be paid and hadn't been paid, and he was sacked that day.
Yeah.
Now, that is the true facts that matter in this case. By being sacked, he only had 60 days within which to find alternative employment or he lost his visa. So it had a big implication. So they applied for interim injunction to require him to be employed and to be remain eligible for the visa while the matters in dispute were going to be agitated to final hearing, which could be 3, 4, 5 months away. But I want to warn you, you know, the world is very simple in workplace law. If you fire someone because they exercise a workplace right, you're dead.
Yeah.
And what this guy did, no matter how he agitated, no matter all the noise that lawyers made, which is good for them, this guy agitated a workplace right and was fired, and he was fired because he agitated that workplace right.
Yeah.
That's it.
An employer thought there was an easy way out because he was on a visa.
Yeah. So, look, I put this in, not Nina, because Nina would have said we're already too full, Andrew, but I put this in because I want people to understand there is a penchant for people engaging in complex arguments, and workplace law, when it's properly practiced, is a narrow discipline that says what are the key facts. In this case, despite all the noise and the legal argument, a person sought to exercise a workplace right and was terminated, and the intention of terminating related to his exercise of that right. It's over.
Yeah.
So I am stunned that they're trying to run it, and I think the only reason they ran it was to try and get around the visa issue.
Yeah.
And I suspect it will settle and we'll never see the final case.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
What are we up to now, Nina? Well, this is I'm over to you now. This is the Australian Law Reform Commission has at last come out in our school industry group, which is a major part of us, and talked about what are the entitlements that religious schools have about who comes to their school.
No,
works at their school.
Yeah, yes. No, they haven't touched that side of it yet.
Sorry.
No, what's interesting because there is a clear focus on slowly stripping back all of those rights that previously were supported under SCOMO to
Scott Morrison, for those who aren't in the know. Bulldozer, if you've read the book by Nikki.
That allowed them to be very selective about who they would employ to make sure that they aligned with their religious beliefs. So now, firstly, they're going to be stripping back the right to discriminate on the basis of sex for any religious schools. I don't think this is going to be a huge change, though, because that is actually already the case in most states and territories. But I think when they start looking at other things like people's views and things like that, that's when really it will shake things up.
And I think the interesting part of that, once we get past gender, but remember gender itself is a much more complex issue, and we've already seen people who are trans people being prevented from working, people who espouse their gay views. They're the sort of things which we're going to start seeing agitated at private schools much more regularly, particularly because we have a greater use of social media and a greater interest in social media on identifying people with difference and prosecuting arguments around them.
Yeah.
So we are going to see more issues raised for those who are on boards of schools. It's going to be a harder place, and for principals, it is already a hard place in faith-based schools. It will get a lot harder, and hopefully the Law Reform Commission continues to drive this process through so principals don't have to have those thorny issues about, well, who's in and who's out, because they no longer will be able to have those discussions.
Yeah, and sorry, to clarify, it's not just sex, it's sexual orientation, marital status and pregnancy, which are all likely to pass.
Okay.
I think this one's my favourite case.
Okay. Now that we put this one in, can I just say there is a principle which says that an employer must indemnify an employee for an action that is brought against an organisation. Okay.
Really?
Yeah, so that's a principle.
For every industry?
Well, yeah, no, it's just in general employment. Provision. Okay. So when you say outrageous things like you regularly do, I have to indemnify you, okay? But in this case, the school was attacked, and it was attacked at not school.
No, it was a law firm.
Law firm was attacked around its reputation, and we'll talk about that in a second. And it damaged the reputation, and therefore that implied indemnity obligation
was waived.
So talk a little bit more about the facts, and I won't pretend it's a school. Okay?
So this was a law firm who had atrociously lying solicitor. So, no, seriously, Andrew, it was bad. Like,
see how the indemnity provisions get enlivened? It's just like that. You know, if Lehman was in the room, somebody would have brought an argument. We would have had another defamation claim right then.
No. Okay, so what happened was there was this client with stage 4 cancer. And the solicitor worked for this firm, which was no win, no fee, and she made up a case. She said that there'd been a case that had gone all the way to the Supreme Court. There was...
She made up, they even acted for people.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean. There was no active case, and she said, we're acting for you in this. We've gone to mediation. We've got a court trial date for you. And this...
Mediator wasn't available because he had COVID. Yeah, well, don't forget that one.
Yeah, but that client went to Sydney with stage 4 cancer to attend the mediation, and the lawyer said, oh, no, the mediator was not available because of COVID, and sent her home. So eventually she found out because she called the Supreme Court and realised there was no case. So she wrote this, like, huge review saying, please don't trust this firm, and basically detailed everything that had happened to her, and then she sadly passed away a couple months later. And so then the law firm has brought this claim for damages against the lawyer because obviously it's cost them their reputation. Who's going to go to a law firm makes up stuff like this?
So there you go. At that stage, when someone goes out and does these things, you're no longer in a position where you can not go after your employer. You can definitely go after your employer where they defame. I just thought I'd let you know that. But where they do something which breaches the standards of the organisation, where they go out on their own and they do something, the rights of indemnity disappear. So,
yeah, because they had a criminal complaint and a New South Wales law complaint against their firm now.
Yeah, okay. So there you go. Interesting case. I think we're onto the major topic, aren't we?
Yeah.
Well, again, Nina's told me not to say this, so I'll say it. As we see around the award modernisation and arguments around what's going to be in the most recent awards, what we really have is a group of people who all eat from the same trough, and that's unions and industry organisations. So in the flexibility space, you would have thought industry organisations would have said, look, we've got enough, let's stay where we are and let's let employers manage that process. You won't be surprised to learn that the Australian Industry Group has gone further than that into flexibility, which you'd sort of look at them and wonder, is that a good idea? No. But the unions have really gone a step a lot further, which is to completely open the flexibility argument to you've got to provide flexibility to all people unless
you can prove unjustifiable hardship. So it's much harder threshold to prove than just reasonable business grounds.
Yeah. And, of course, all of us know that how do we prove the needs for socialisation, the needs for collective thinking in person, or how do we do those things which we know are incredibly important and there are people who just don't want to come back to work? How do we work as an organisation under those circumstances?
But it's not just that. There would be organisations where people request something and it just wouldn't fit within the business plan to do it because it'd be like an excessive use of staff, and that would not cause unjustifiable hardship. But if you had to then grant everything, then how could you possibly run a business?
I know, it's just nonsense. And unfortunately, as with all fashionable concepts, you know, flexible work has reached the stage of entitlement based on a Herald Sun version of what is flexible work, which is absolute flexibility, working from home all the time. And now we've got unions saying, yeah, I agree with that, irrespective of how it impacts industry.
Yeah.
And
you've
got
it will practically apply.
And you've got an industry group who's seeding ground on an issue which every employer is complaining about and saying, this is causing us enormous problems with the current law. So we've really raised it because...
To be clear, those employer associations are not supporting the unjustified...
No, they're not doing that, but they are seeding other ground on it. And the issue for us is someone needs to ring them up on a regular basis and say, actually, you actress, can you stop doing it? And take a stronger stance around, well, let's talk about the law says flexibility under very limited circumstances, and let's give employers a power to actually manage their workforce rather than to have that power removed from them. And by ceding little bits of ground, you feed the fire.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's, you can see today is my rant day, really, isn't it?
Yeah, who's indemnifying you for all this?
Yeah, me.
Under the case study.
Now, can I just say about this case study? This was typed on a plane and in the back of a hire car on the way to work today. So if there's,
but I fixed it.
Did you?
Yeah.
That's good. You're indemnifying me then.
It's like a vicious cycle. Emil was a counsellor for Real Life Limited. RL was a not-for-profit company that focused on youth justice with a vertically integrated service provision, starting with services that include counselling and advocacy for children who have suffered trauma, including violence and sexual assault. It was common for Emil to work alongside youth justice advocates in RL who pursued both legal and social justice for harmed adolescents. They undertook the sessions outside usual work hours as it suited them both.
We'll come back to that. Ignore that last bit.
As part of her role, she read case studies, saw photographs and videos that were graphic. Emil, like all psychological counsellors, was subject to a clinical supervisor, Carl. This was different to her work supervisor, Megan. Carl spoke to Emil about her workload. They spoke about difficult matters and he would test her reasoning and suggested treatment paths. He also checked in on her. The supervision was always undertaken virtually as Carl lived in Canberra and Emil in Melbourne.
And was always done out of hours because it suited them both. That was actually...
Yeah.
You fixed that.
I'm going to complain to Seb. Carl did not observe any discernible change in her until 13th of March 2024. Emil attended the session with him in tears and explained she was having graphic nightmares of many of the things she had read and saw, and nothing seemed to stop them. He recommended she get professional help immediately and tell her bosses. She said she had already done both. Carl sought and was given permission to speak directly with the head of clinical care at RL. Like Carl, the head of clinical care lived in Canberra and worked with Carl as lead counsellors and trainers for RL. In February 2024, her supervisor at work, Megan, became concerned by Emil's obvious mental deterioration. She had many absenteeism issues, stopped her cautious style of grooming, appeared sad, was often sullen and uncommunicative, and several clients had complained she appeared uncaring. A stark contrast, to her past behaviour.
Yeah, you fixed it.
You gave me like a minute. I fixed a lot more than this. Megan arranged a private chat with Emil on 7th of February 2024. She explained her observations and also client concern. Emil asked, is this performance management? Megan clumsily said, you need to tell us what the problem is and how we can help, but I also need to protect our clients. Emil said, so you don't trust me. I am leaving. Megan said, please don't take this the wrong way. I care about you, but also must ensure our clients are safe. It was all too late. Emil left and slammed the door. For the next 2 weeks, Emil's attendance was erratic. This put clients at risk. Megan and HR several times wrote to her and arranged meetings with her seeking clarification on what was distressing her, how they could help and their client concerns and how to best manage, but she refused to attend.
I'll take over. On the morning of 13 March 2024, she'd been directed to attend a meeting with Megan and HR. It was a lawful and reasonable direction. She attended with the union organiser. Within seconds of entering the room, she looked at Megan, shouted, you're trying to sack me. I have no choice. I'm resigning, and left. All right. Nina's got some problems after reading my very lengthy story, so I'll just read the questions and we'll talk. If she came back tomorrow and said it was a heat of the moment, would her resignation have ended her employment? And the answer, as we've said before, is no. And look, I put it in there just, I guess, to remind people that lots of people do things when they're upset. And just cool your heels. Even if it's somebody you desperately want to go, make sure you connect and communicate with them the next day to satisfy they're safe.
Yeah.
And also, if it is a permanent decision, you document the decision and send them
after you talk to them clarify. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's good. We've got that one. We've agreed that one together. We haven't tested this today, by the way, so we could come up with very, very different answers. Other than clinical supervision, there was no other safety system around her work. Was this a breach of safety law?
Yes.
Yeah, that's an absolutely. Kozarov clinical like court services.
Particularly because they were well aware of it. Like she had raised her concerns, and having a clinical supervision is better than having just EAP, but it's not enough because it didn't actually do anything to eliminate or reduce.
And it also has an administrative barrier from her work, so you can't go around that. You can look after on this side of clinical supervision, but you can't go around and change her work behaviour. That is left as a job to her.
Yeah.
So, again, if we look at the truck case, if we look at the other cases we've talked about, like the Covington Grammar, here is a known high risk. The High Court case is telling you this is a high risk. Yeah. And to not have a system that actually
not deals even a basic system
means you're in heaps and heaps of trouble.
Mm.
Particularly if we go to the next question, is other than clinical supervision, there was no other no, that's we've done that?
Yes, we've done that.
Okay, I think we have got this. Let's go again. Next go.
Next slide.
Next one. Here we go. Could Emile have
made a worker's comp claim?
No, I wanted to go. There is one that's missing here, which is if as a result of this treatment, Emile walked out in front of traffic and injured herself because she was so disconnected from the world and was full of anxiety, is there a claim that could have been brought against Megan and the organisation? And the answer is, absolutely there is. It's a reckless endangerment.
But I don't think it would be industrial manslaughter.
No, not industrial manslaughter, but let's just step through why. At the time they went to see her, she'd not attend any meeting she was directed to go to. At that stage, you're on definite notice this is a person who is in a high level of stress, acting naughtily, but at the same time in a very high level of stress. Whatever you'd have to do at that stage, you would have staged an intervention before you even got to any performance-based discussion to satisfy that she was in a safe place.
I think this is really important because a lot of times we've had clients come to us and say, oh, it's because the employee is not cooperating, so we've done everything that we can. But just asking people for meetings is not sufficient to discharge your onus.
No, because once you – look, Burke and Suncorp started a discussion, North General Health followed that in Kubert's case. One of the things that monitoring health means under safety law, and it follows into other workplace law because that's where Burke and Suncorp and Kubert in those cases come from, is the moment monitoring is triggered, that is an appreciation of a person that has a health-related issue, you've got to stop everything and go, all right, what do I need to do to satisfy myself that person is safe? Now, if they're in work, in other words, still employed, it doesn't matter if they're at home, I need to then understand, is this person safe? So first thing is I need to find out they're safe. Second, I need to satisfy myself before I take any further steps that any discussion we're going to have is going to be a safe discussion. Now, that means advising the person of the nature of the inquiry you're about to do and why you're having this conversation. And it should be a focus on their health, not on the risks that are arising. So at that stage, we get straight to reckless endangerment because we have a knowledge of risk, a serious injury or death, and although we do something about it, we're going to have a general conversation about performance, about risk to clients, all this thing, that's not enough.
Yeah.
So it gets to the carelessness that goes to reckless endangerment. So I think Megan would probably escape it because she's clearly an innocent, if that makes sense. Not innocent of the wrongdoing, but when you look at what she's doing, she's fumbled and made mistakes, but her best interests, courts wouldn't like her prosecuted, okay? But they'd certainly go after the organisation given its corporate knowledge.
Mm.
And that's under any state jurisdiction, you know, whether it's under Section 144, actual knowledge of officers within organisations. I think the officers would be at risk here as well. So anyway, look, an interesting case study. I thought we'd better move on. I just saw your face then that says we have 30 seconds left. Would Emile have any other legal claims and will fold in workers' compensation? She'd definitely have a workers' claim. She brought it at any stage. And there's some real arguments, had she been represented by lawyers early on, they would have set up adverse action claims. So I think this is a case that shows from what appears a relatively simple issue of someone suffering, you're trying to work out what was going wrong and then trying to manage it, but balance client interests, that you've actually turned into a position of turmoil where there's huge amounts of liability and you're harming someone.
Yeah.
So that's it, really. Now, what's up next week? I don't know. We've been running a bit hot this week, haven't we?
Thank you for joining us for like a very jam-packed session.
Yeah, then thanks for tolerating us as well, me anyway, for being grumpy.
Give us a thumbs up.
See you next week. Bye. Cheers. Bye-bye.